So I'm faced with a very unfortunate choice, I think, from my point of view. I don't like it. I've had to think about it a lot, probably more than is healthy. and this is going like 6 months now. And I've kind of hinted at this here and there in some of the other podcasts, but oh man, I just don't think I can go on anymore. Not like this. And so, you know, if you don't like this and it upsets you, I love you and thank you and feel free to just wave me goodbye, right? But I am driven to this conclusion. And that is that if I am going to in any way continue to walk through the book of Revelation as part of this podcast, I can't do it the same way I was doing it before. Now, I don't know why or how I managed to have time eked out in my week before to prepare and study the way I was, and why I don't now, because I actually think I have less to do now. It's not entirely true, but like, I really do. Like, I'm the master of my own time now because I'm a parish pastor. And yeah, there's emergencies and there's things you got to do and scheduling. But it's, you know, you would think I'd be able to find a morning every week that I could just give over to completely, immersing myself in Old Testament study, and then give the afternoon to recording it. But for whatever reason, I don't feel like that's what I was doing before. I don't think I spent that much time on it. So I have no idea. But I can't take the guilt anymore. Because, like, on the one hand, here's the problem, right? On the one hand, I know that Raw sort of began with, hey, I'm just going to talk about Revelation off the cuff. We'll just kind of do it for fun, see what comes of it. And then I got into hardcore history and I was like, oh, this is really cool. And I started studying some stuff because I wanted to know a little more myself for the Revelation stuff. And then I started, you know, kind of, it all merged into what I think were some really, really cool episodes that did some really cool things, particularly with the Old Testament story stuff, right? And I'm not saying that that's gone forever, period, but maintaining that as a show or as a production takes a certain level of, again, preparation that I just don't have time to do. And so it's either never do another Raw Revelation episode. Raw wouldn't go away, right? Doing lots of other stuff. I hope you're enjoying that other stuff. I want to do more of that other stuff. But I would have to leave Revelation behind. It's like, well, I can't compete with what I did, and so I guess it's just dead. So that was the one option. And a couple of you out there, when I kind of asked this I think I asked it in Facebook a while ago, and you kind of said, I'd rather wait and only have Revelation when you're really ready to do what you were doing. And I was like, okay, yeah, I agree, because it was better. It's good. Man, I'm not going to ever be able to do it again. I just don't know how. Right? I don't know how. I know my mom, God bless my mom. Hi, mom. she said the one on, what was it? The Eagle of Many Colors. I don't think that was the title, but that was really good and it was just so cool. And I'm like, great. But that was like 60% value of what I used to do. Like, it just didn't live up to what I used to do. So for me, it was like this heavy weight. And even in that, it took time that week that caused issues for me and other types of production that I want to do. So I'm just stuck with this choice, which is that either I abandon Revelation, which I don't want to do, or I just go at it with a little bit of a different angle, probably moving faster, probably having less Old Testament completion, where I go and actually get the goods for you every step of the way. Not that I'm not going to point you to it, but where I'm going to just kind of point you to it. And if you want to go dig more, you got to dig more. And it's not that I don't ever do it the same, but I just don't. Well, do you feel my pain? Do you feel my pain? I've been listening recently. I always listen to a number of different podcasts when I'm driving places. And Tim Ferriss and his sort of how to maximize output while minimizing input, do more with less point of view and the way he interviews world-class performers, it really, you know, encourages me. I always come away with it with ideas to apply to life and church too, believe it or not. And one of the things that in a most recent episode they were talking about was maintaining an ongoing production in which you are pretending to be something that you're not, but you're doing it because you think it's what people want. And then if it works, you're kind of trapped by that and enslaved by that. In fact, if I recall, the guy he was talking to does this, was it a cooking show? Yeah, it's like weird food show. I can't remember his name at all. Weird food show where like he goes into other cultures and goes in their weirdest kind of restaurant that we would be like, whoa, and like digs into it, okay? And then like eats it and shares it and talks about it. And he was confronted with the first episode, the pilot episode, a situation in which it would have been really easy to be kind of snidely humorous and make fun of the thing because to the American ear, the way the pun would have worked, it would have been really funny. But he didn't do it. And he was really glad afterwards he didn't because he wanted to do this show in which he showed respect for the other people's food, even if we would not normally eat this ourselves. And he also would have been trapped then having to be funny every show from then on. And he just would, you know, he said in the interview, this is not me. I would have been awful. I've been having to pretend to be someone else. And for those of you who are Worldview Everlasting fans, that's sort of what finally happened with Worldview Everlasting. I mean, there were a number of other things, but for me and the production side of it and the emotion side of it, the reason I haven't gone back to doing video anywhere else yet, I do plan to, I hope to, but was that character who you saw on the show, Rev Fisk, whoever that guy was, there are elements of him that's me, but there was a lot of him that wasn't me. There was a lot of that was a show. I adopted a character and I played him. And that's the thing that eventually just wore me down, was like, oh, I have to pretend to be that guy again. And, you know, how long can you, as an actor, play the same role over and over again, night in, night out? You know, eventually, you grow weary of it. How many times can you read the same book, right, over and over and over again? I'm not talking about the Bible, right? How many times are you going to listen to the same piece of music over and over again? Eventually, just kind of like, okay, I'm done with this. So, going back to this guy who did the food show, his statement, I think it's really kind of genius, is the only way that that doesn't happen to you when you're producing something is if you just are doing what you are doing. If you're just you. You do it the way you would want to do it or would feel it or would experience it or would desire it, that kind of thing. Because don't get me wrong, this guy, Jonathan here, talking to you, he likes the Bible. He likes teaching the Bible. There is nothing in my week that I get more energy out of than when I get to stand up in front of Bible class and just go. And I think you can ask the people in my parish here at this point, like, it's an intense 45 minutes. Sadly, we only have 45 minutes on Sundays, but it's an intense time. My Wednesday morning one is great. I went in this week, and I didn't really have anything planned, and I put one thing on the board, so that's where we left off, and we had questions and just conversation, and it just went right for an hour. Boom! And it was great. Oh, I love it. So that's there. That's there, and I can keep doing that, and I can keep doing that with Revelation. Last night, I was fortunate enough to hang out with a couple of my elders. They shall remain nameless, although if you live in Facebook world, you know both of them. If you live in Lutheran Facebook world, you know both of them, or you have heard of at least both of them, probably. But anyway, we're hanging out with the fire pit, enjoying a cigar, and talking theology, trying to talk about how to save the world, the fall of Western civilization. We've got to do something about that. But, you know, Christianity is a big part of that. We really want to have our congregation be a bastion of truth, all this kind of stuff. And we got into just a little conversation about Revelation. And up to that point, it had been like a mutual conversation where we're all going back and forth with each other. And then it was like Pastor Fisk talking for 25 minutes. I just took over. Because I said afterwards, I'm sorry, it's my hobby horse. I'm sorry. I didn't even take over. And, you know, the guy was like, oh, no, thank you. Give me a lot to chew on. So It's not as though I don't want to teach Revelation and actually work through this series. I just can't pretend to be Dan Carlin forever. Dude's a master, and he spends 3 to 5 months on each show that he does, right? And mine were an hour, his are 4 hours, but that's like the only show he does in that 3 to 4 months. And because of the breadth of reach that he has, I don't know how he pays for it. I mean, it's his job, right? But I don't know how he does that. He's got someone paid to do all the editing. I don't have that, right? So there's all these pieces. And to mimic him is just more than I can do in a couple hours. So what are we going to do today? If you're still listening after this little Fisk rant here, if you're still listening and if you're not already going over to Patreon to unsubscribe me, what we're going to do here is I'm just going to dig on Revelation chapter 9 here a bit and the sixth trumpet's beginning. And I'm going to do it in a way that's a little, again, this is going to be more fluid. We're not going to have quite as many clear connection points where I go and like prove to you what I'm saying. But hopefully I give you, again, at least something to ponder as you dig through the text. One way to understand the text with Old Testament informing it, all that is still going to be there as best I can. We're just going to not be as, well, in my opinion, not as entertaining, because I find Dan Carlin very entertaining. So I do have another rant, though, to kind of give you as well. And this is sort of where the conversation over the fire pit last night went. And these guys weren't, you know, problematic. I'm so grateful for them as men in Christ and brothers in Christ and elders who are there to support me and check me even within the church. It's great. But the reason I kind of went on that 20-minute tirade was to emphasize something that I've talked about it a lot through the Revelation thing and through the conversations with Pastor Wolf Mueller. We've gone back and forth on this, but I'm just not sure. It's the kind of thing that doesn't stick very easily because there is this built-in assumption about the end of time and the end of the world, that this really strongly built-in assumption that even really good amillennial, that is, not believing in premillennial dispensationalist theologians, still have trouble not kind of grabbing onto just a little bit. And the trick is, there's no text to tell us to do this. Now, what am I talking about? I'm talking about the hyper-common, the normal and natural belief that before Jesus comes back, before the last day, at the end of the world, there is going to be, observably so, a worse time of history than all the other times leading up to that moment. That right before Jesus comes back, it'll be worse than it ever was. And somehow we're not going to know that that's happening. Like, it's not a sign, right? Except for that it is. That it'll get worse. So, for example, the text in Revelation 9, 13 and following talks about four angels who release twice 10,000 times 10,000 mounted troops who go out wearing breastplates the color of fire and sapphire and sulfur, with heads on the horses like lions' heads and smoky sulfur coming out of their mouths, and kill a third of mankind. By three plagues, a third of mankind was killed by fire, smoke, sulfur coming out of their mouths. The power of the horses is in their mouths and in their tails. And you're reading along in sainted, blessed Dr. Brighton's Revelation commentary, in which he has established for you the idea that Revelation is an apocalyptic book, that is symbolic, it's code, and in which almost everything that you've seen has been understood as connected to or representing something else, particularly when you're dealing with numbers. And then suddenly, he just says, I mean, you can go read it, and I'm just disagreeing with him. I got nothing against him personally, right? We just have a theological disagreement, and he's sainted, so he's fine now, right? But he just asserts this is a real death of one third of the people on the earth right before Jesus comes back. It's literal. And I'm just at a loss to figure out on what basis in the text are we suddenly going to decide that everything that's been before behind what we're watching in the world right now that's not there and now we're at the end of the world, but it's before the end of the world and we're going to see a third of mankind died. A third. 33% of the people on the earth are going to die. That's what, if you take it literally, that's what's going to happen. Now, this does a couple of things, but the most important thing it does is it means Jesus can't come back today, Jesus can't come back tomorrow, Jesus can't come back until a third of mankind dies in like a couple of days. And you'd think, well, if that one happened, then you're going to be like, oh, we know the day and the hour, it's pretty close, right? All that bit about no one knows the day or the hour. And the other verse that continues to be my key, right, my hermeneutical rock that I stand on, is our Lord's words in Matthew 24 and 25, in which he states that when he comes back, the only thing that'll be happening is that everything will be happening just as it's always been happening, as in the days of Noah. They'll be marrying and giving in marriage. Life's going to be going on just like it has forever. No one's going to see this thing coming. Except for the, you know, one third of the people are just dead on the ground, but no one notices. We just bury them, right? No. And the only thing I can say, like the only reason I can come up with that the commentary says, well, this is real now, is because there is this assumption that there has to be some sort of worse time before the end of the world. And that assumption, I'm ranting right now. I am going to scream at the wind. That assumption is an assumption that you cannot, with any text of scripture that is clear, make the case that before Jesus comes back, there has to be some sort of amplified thing for the worsening of life on this planet for humans and for Christians, all that stuff. You can't, there's no text that says that. There are texts that say you don't know the day or the hour. There are texts that say it's going to be just like it always has been. And then you got this stuff from Revelation, which is crazy. It's just crazy madness. And you come to it and you just start making up a timeline in which this stuff gets shoved to the back of the timeline. And then I got to ask you, well, where are you getting this from? And the only place to get it from is from what I mentioned earlier, premillennial dispensationalism, this nonsense systematic that just destroys scripture on a number of levels, which insists that Revelation is a timeline for the end of the world. And you got to just kind of put it all on the timeline. And most of the prophecies of old, some of them are fulfilled by Jesus, but a lot of them weren't. They still have to be fulfilled too, and you end up just dancing all over the place. You go Google premillennial dispensational map or something like that, and you can find these insanely complex drawings in which they're trying to timeline out everything. Madness. But we Lutherans, really unwittingly, and many other Christians, I guess I should say as well, we've adopted that mentality about the end of the world. So you can go look at Missouri Synod publications on the timeline for the end of the world, and they'll be like really against premillennialism. It'll make it very clear that there is no millennium on the earth preceded by a tribulation on the earth after which the end of the world happens. We take out that millennium, that reign of Christ on earth, but then we leave this little tiny tribulation thing in there on our amillennial diagram, and I don't know why. Oh, because Revelation talks about the little season of Satan? Is that why? Okay. Wait, which book was it again? Oh, Revelation. Is it a symbol? Oh, yeah, huh. It's all symbols. So then why is this one suddenly, which isn't even a number at this point, why is this suddenly something we're going to take literally? I told you I was going to rant, so I hope you're still listening. There is nothing more important to your eschatology than to recognize that Jesus could come back in 2 minutes. There's nothing that needs to happen before Jesus can come back. And then when you come to chapter 9, verse 13, and the sixth angel blows his trumpet, and we hear a voice from the four horns of the golden altar before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, "Release the four angels who are bound to the great river Euphrates," and they go, and they're prepared for that day and that hour and that month and the year, and they kill a third of mankind. Well, then, that's going to work the same way all the other thirds have been working up to this point. You remember that? This isn't the first third. In the first four trumpets, you've got a bunch of other thirds going on, right? I've got to click back here to look at it, but first trumpet. Third of the trees burned up. Second trumpet, third of living creatures in the sea die. Third trumpet, third of the rivers on the earth become wormwood and bitter. Fourth trumpet, third of the day might be kept from shining, and likewise a third of the night. Then the woes come, right? And if you remember what we talked about at that point, I mean, this isn't like, I can't prove this to you with the biblical text. Sorry. Other than that, well, I kind of can, but not really. A third, if you're going to look at a third as a number, what is a third of something, right? Is it a lot or is it a little? It's kind of specially placed like that, right? A quarter is a little. Like it's not, a quarter is not very much of a dollar, right? And we don't have a third piece, but it would still be on that little end, right? It's not a half. It's not a 50-cent piece. It's not that big. But it's a lot more than a quarter. Now, take it away from quarter and dollar. I mean, think about this. Think about when you go out to dinner, you know, you and two people go out to dinner and you spend $25. Yeah? And then think about you go out to dinner and you spend $34. Think about the difference in that, right? It's a big difference. And so when, but it ain't $50, right? And it ain't the whole, shebang either. It's not the whole thing. Not $100. So a third is a minority. It's a small thing that's still big enough to be noticeable, right? And the way that I believe John is using this in all of these trumpets, including the sixth trumpet, is to imply that at every time, at all times, there's this one third, there's a significant minority of these things happening. And we talked about, you know, the trees and the grass, right? This is just dealing with, at all times, the earth is under tribulation, under curse, is under futility. Like Paul says in Romans chapter 8, we're confined to our utility. And at all times, the sea creatures are dying, right? It's that there is always a negative. The curse is always present, but not in such a way to actually put an end to things. If you killed all the sea creatures would be gone. But if there's only a third of them dying, well, then they can continue to go on, to propagate. And so this is now what's happening to men too. Mankind is not separate from this. In the fifth trumpet, we see that the devil has, in fact, an army on his side, and he's tormenting the world. And in the sixth trumpet, we see that there is also an army that has been unleashed by God to put an end to the lives of men. Now, how is this not Genesis 3's theology? How is this not what's been going on from the beginning? Are we not seeing people die every single day? It's not a third of the earth's population that dies every single day, but it's a lot of people. It's a lot of people. And there's some more that are born. And it just keeps happening, right? We don't lose everyone in one day or everyone in one year or decade. But you, wow, actually over a decade per generation, particularly. So death here in the sixth trumpet is being sent out again to mankind. And in the real meaning of this, the real thing behind this is to show the fusion of the demonic hordes and their unbridled wrath, that's the scorpion part from the fifth trumpet, and the fact that they are bridled like horses. They are so bridled that they can't do what they want to do until God lets them. And yet when God lets them, they go out and they do it, and we can't stop it at all, right? So see 5 and 6 here is as the same group. Those beasts and hordes of hell, the locusts with all the weird, crazy, you know, women's faces, lion's teeth and all that. In fact, you notice the lion's mouths are back again in this one. So there's an overlap here. And they're going throughout the world, and they are trying to deceive us away from God, and at the same time, they are bringing death and decay wherever they go. And that's what they do, but not without a check from God. So the check starts with this, right? So angel blows the trumpet. We've talked about trumpets. There's a voice. This is interesting. There's a voice, verse 13, from the four horns of the golden altar before God. I don't know how much you know about the altar in the temple in Jerusalem. I mean, John's talking about the altar in heaven where all the saints are under it. We've talked about this already in the throne room, going back to chapters 4 and 5. But that altar is a fulfillment of a greater thing than the shadow which it cast into the tabernacle of old. And that altar was made very specifically according to prescriptions which God gave. You can find these in Exodus chapter 30. You shall make an altar on which to burn incense. You shall make it of acacia wood. A cubit, that's about an arm's length, shall be its length, and a cubit its breadth. Wait, actually, hold on. Cubit, arm's length? That ain't right. I think that's right. 18 inches, yeah, an arm's length. A cubit shall be its length, and a cubit its breadth. It shall be square, and two cubits shall be its height. Its horns shall be of one piece with it. So it's got horns. What does that mean? You shall overlay it with pure gold, its top and around its sides and its horns. And you shall make a molding of gold around it. You shall make two golden rings for it. Under its molding on two opposite sides of it, you shall make them, and they shall be holders for poles with which to carry it. You shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold, and you shall put it in front of the veil that is above the ark of the testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is above the testimony where I will meet with you. And Aaron shall burn fragrant incense on it. Every morning when he dresses the lamps, he shall burn it. And when Aaron sets up the lamps at twilight, he shall burn it, a regular incense offering before Yahweh throughout your generations. Two more verses. You shall not offer unauthorized incense on it, or a burnt offering, or a grain offering, and you shall not pour out a drink offering on it. Aaron shall make atonement on its horns once a year with the blood of the sin offering of atonement. He shall make atonement for it once in the year throughout your generations. It is most holy to Yahweh the Lord. Now, I mean, oh, I am not an expert. This is where, like, it'd be good for me to go study, right? We could go spend an hour just on this. The layout and the placement of the altar of incense within the tabernacle structure, within the covenantal system, with all of its feast days and holidays and different sacrifices that go on. And this is, so at the very least, we get straight from the text here. Every day, there is incense that is burned, I think twice, in front of the Ark of the Covenant on this special altar that is not very big, right? 1.5 feet by 1.5 feet and 3 feet high with horns, which means, and it doesn't tell us which horns, I bet you somebody knows, but I just got to imagine either oxen horns or sheep and goats horns, but these horns are attached to the acacia wood that it's built out of, and then the whole thing is crusted in gold. Right, so they become part of their golden horns. But here's where, you know, I can't help you much. I don't know what those horns are for. I don't know why they're there. That makes me feel really incompetent as a human being to say that out loud. I would like to know. And, well, there you go. It happened. By the magic of modern internet, I know. Look at that. I just figured it all out. Well, it took me 25 minutes or so. Isn't that crazy? Like, does it sound like I'm just continuing the conversation? But I'm not. There was like 25 minutes of my life that just went by. And I want to dig a little bit, because I do want to know this. Like the horns. What's up with the horns? Why are there horns on the altar? So first off, the altar that's being talked about, in all likelihood, is one of two, right, that have horns. And the one that Revelation is referencing is not the one you're thinking of. You're probably thinking of the one where they're burning animal sacrifices on it. But the one that's in the holy place, which is where the one in Revelation is as well, where the saints are, that is the altar of incense, right, that the prayers of the saints go up on, right? Let my prayer rise before you as incense. And it is, again, we just described it, the size, 1.5 feet, 1.5 feet, 3 feet, covered in gold. The horns are the horns of oxen, we are told. Although, you know, when I found that, that's about the other one, which I'll talk about in a minute. So maybe they aren't oxen, but I think they are. And again, every day the incense is offered there. But this smaller incense altar is like a mirror or a reflection of that other altar that you're more used to thinking about, that's outside the actual tabernacle in the courtyard, where the sacrifices are being burned, the burned offerings, right? That thing's much bigger. It's not gold, it's bronze. It's got horns, though, the same way. Definitely oxen horns. And those two items, the incense that was offered morning and evening, was supposed to be happening at the same time as a burnt offering that was happening morning and evening. So they're like working together. And the burnt offering is like the atoning thing. It's where the blood sacrifice is paying for reality, right? The incense is the reflection or the reaction or the follow-up or the fruit of that atonement that the prayers and the spiritual life of the nation in the priest now ascend to God, the high priest now ascend to God and intercede on behalf of the people. But the horns were a big part of this because for the altar of sacrifice in the courtyard, the blood of the sacrifice was to be smeared on the horns. They were to take their fingers and paint the horns with this blood. So in many ways, they were the centerpiece of the altar. It wasn't the burning, it was the blood on the horns that mattered. And there's another way in which the horns are important. Because if you were fleeing from your enemies, if something had happened, particularly in the realm of manslaughter, you could go to the altar and throw yourself on the horns, like grab onto the horns. And it would be sort of like a request for mercy and judgment. And so if you did that and you had not actually murdered the guy on purpose, you would not be able to be killed by your enemy. Now, Exodus 20, oh, where'd it go now? 21 does talk about like if the man has actually willfully attacked another by cunning, you can cling to the horns of the altar all you want. You're going to get killed. They're going to take you out and kill you. But it's a place of mercy. So see it as it's the place where the atonement happens and it's the place of mercy. It still doesn't really answer the question why the horns, right? Why horns at all? And Kyle and Dalich sort of try to answer that, but again, they fall prey to the same complaint I had earlier in this episode, so I can't put too much stock in it. You know, okay, yeah, you asserted that that's what it is, but where is your biblical proof of this? But it does make sense. Okay, it does at least make sense. They say, the significance of the altar culminated in its horns, upon which the blood of the sin offering was smeared, right? That's what we were talking about. Just as in the case of the horned animals, their strength and beauty are concentrated in the horns. And the horn has become, in consequence, a symbol of strength or of the fullness of vital energy. So the significance of the altar as a piece of the saving and life-giving power of God which the Lord bestows upon his people in his kingdom was concentrated in the horns of the altar. Now, I don't know if they are right about it's the animal's symbol of strength and vitality. Okay, well, that sounds really good, but is there a Bible verse that tells us this? They don't point me to one. I'm not going to go look for that right now. But what they are right about, without question, is that the saving power of the altar was concentrated in the horns and the blood that goes on the horns. You know what it does make me think of? I mean, this is the shadows and types kind of thing, but what it makes me think of is nails in the wrists and feet of a man on a cross, right? The saving power is the blood on the nails, right? It's not the nails themselves, but that's that place of atonement, the place to go for mercy. So if that helps, but again, that's just kind of my own read and my own understanding there, my own kind of twist on it. But now kind of jumping back again to the horns of the altar are the center of the saving power of the altar. And in Revelation chapter 9, the sixth angel blows his trumpet, and the voice comes from the horns of the golden altar of incense that's there before God. So whose voice is this? The four horns of the altar are speaking. Who are the horns? And that kind of comes back to you, which is I was just talking about. This is the place of prayer. There's no question about that. The altar of incense is the place of prayer, but the horns are not. The horns are the connection to the sacrificial altar, right? They're the mirror of it. So I'm going to say that this is actually the voice of Jesus, the voice of God, speaking with his church, certainly for his church, even through his church. But he's the one who then speaks. And what does he say? He says, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. Now, I think we've dealt with these guys already. But you kind of got to look at it through a weird lens. And I mean, they're called angels here. So it's not very often that you have groups of angels that are treated as intentional groups. So you always want to check and see, are there others who fit this bill? Has this group already been referred to? And you definitely have the cherubim and seraphim, the four angels that are surrounding the throne of God, crying, holy, holy, holy. But that doesn't seem to be who these are. The cherubim and seraphim are not bound to the great river Euphrates. So who are these people? And if you go back, and this is two episodes you'd have to go back and listen to, but go back and listen to the two episodes on the four horsemen of the apocalypse, death, war, famine, and rage, pride, power, authority, whatever the last one is. You kind of, well, if you're not going to be too hung up on them having to be hallmark angels, and you can understand that they're in fact fallen angels that are still bound by God and being used for his purposes. So then there they are waiting to unleash death, war, famine upon the entire earth once God gives them the go, which is exactly what you end up looking at. When you go back and you don't just read the text on the four horsemen of the apocalypse in Revelation, but you go back and look at the Zechariah stuff, with the horsemen there, they're waiting for orders. They're waiting for to be told to go and do this. And so what are they released to do? And think about this. I mean, death, war, famine, right? So the four angels who've been prepared were released to kill a third of mankind. It does ring significantly like it's the exact same thing. And so I think it is. I think it's the exact same thing. But now you're seeing, again, a different perspective. You're looking at the cup from a different angle. And again, in parallel to the locust armies that were just going out a moment ago with the fifth trumpet as demons, now you're seeing it from God's perspective. They're still bound into their angelic duty. They can't escape their angelic duty, even though they're trying to just be malicious and destroy and torment, right? And so the number of these troops, they go out. Before we get to the numbers, though, I've been kind of skipping over it as I read it in verse 15. The four angels who had been prepared for the hour, the day, the month, and the year. Now, that is where Brighton really hangs his hat in terms of this is an actual time, like before the end of the world, because of the definite article, the hour, the day, the month, and the year. So he's saying that because it says that, it can't be all time. I actually couldn't disagree more, not only just because of what I said earlier, but I think that the fact that all these things are symbolic all the way through, and now he does say, you know, the hour, the day, the month, the year, he's describing a small portion of every moment that ever was, all in one little phrase. And he even quotes one of the earliest Latin commentaries on the book of Revelation by a guy named Prismasius, states all the way back to the 6th century. And he says about this very verse, he says, "Step by step, days are filled with hours, months with days, and years with months." Which is to say, Prismasius thinks, and this I'm totally with him on this, totally agree, he's absolutely right, the hour of the day, the month, and the year is really just a way of saying every moment of every day of every year ever. Which is kind of the... I'm sorry, I'm laughing. Like, this is, I've been saying this, it's the whole point, right? When is the Great Tribulation? From fall to return of Christ. When is the millennium kingdom reign? It is from the resurrection to forever of Christ, right? When is Revelation as a book? It is behind time, all time, right? It's always like this. It's always here. So, it really comes down to it. Go look at it. Go look at Revelation 9:15 and you decide, you know, the four angels prepared for the hour, the day, the month, and the year. Is this about the future or is this all time? Are they going to be released at some point soon so Jesus can't come back until it happens to kill a third of mankind? Or is this the four horsemen of the apocalypse doing what they've been doing since earlier in the book, which actually goes all the way back to the curse of Genesis 3 and the casting out of the garden, killing a third of mankind at any one time? I mean, we're always just in the state of dying, but also not so much that we stop existing. I mean, in any case, well, I made my case. The number of mounted troops was twice 10,000 times 10,000, which is a lot. In fact, it's 100 million times two, right? 100 million times two, 200 million troops. That is a mind-boggling number, and that's the point. I don't know what the symbolism of the two times 10,000 is. You know, we've talked before, 10 is always a complete number. 1,000 is always 10 to the third power, so God's number. But now we're at the 10,000 and the two in there. I really don't know. I really don't know. What I think it is just really big. Like, it's so big that we should be, if you saw an army this size coming at you in your little town or your little city, you would either just prepare to die or you would run. There's no standing against this army. I think that's the point. Like the locusts before, right? There's no standing against this army. And he describes them. He sees the horses, which brings us back to, again, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, right? He just said the four angels earlier, but now it says the four horses. Now it says the horses, that they've got horses. And so it's like, okay, and you go back and run that through Zechariah, and you have the horsemen that are going to and fro. They're not alone. It's just four horsemen. They've got armies with them. So here you go. It's all piling together. It's all the same idea. Why do we need to change it and make this about something later? I don't know. Because we're just addicted to believing there's going to be some little minor tribulation before the end of time. I don't get it. But so their troops, though, on horses. And the horses in the vision have... this is really cool. Actually, it's describing first, I guess, the troops on the horses. This is so cool. Breastplates of fire and sapphire, right? So like blue gemstone breastplates burning with fire. Oh, isn't that cool? And then there's sulfur, which now it's not so cool. Now we're dealing with punishment. Sulfur in the Bible is always about, you know, fire and brimstone, right? This is like hell kind of stuff. And now the heads of the horses are a lot like these locusts from before, who also had breastplates, remember? Right? So we're kind of like, you're getting two perspectives of the same fallen angelic horde, right? And they got the lion's heads, but so they look like the Lion of Judah again. They look like they want to be royal, but from their mouth comes fire, smoke, and sulfur. This is not good. This is bad. This is the abyss, right? This is the angels of the abyss. And he talks about that being then three different plagues, the fire, the smoke, and the sulfur, which again, I think the point of this, why the number three, why all the holy references here, the 10,000 and all that, you're getting God behind this. This is the point that the demonic horde of the locust angel beasts, demon beasts, is actually God's military army. Yes, they rebelled against him, and he has those who have not, but he still is controlling them. He binds them, he unleashes them when he needs to, and he moves them all for the good of those who are in Christ Jesus. And in that, he's allowing a third of mankind to always be dying by the fire, the smoke, and the sulfur coming out of the mouths of our enemy demonic hordes. And then he says, the power of the horses is in their mouths and in their tails, which, if I recall, just a few verses ago, they have tails and stings like scorpions, and their power is in their tails, right? So there's all this echo, there's all this overlap of trumpet 5 and trumpet 6 here. Remember the stone thrown in the pond that's kind of rippling out. It's just getting deeper into the same picture, just describing it from a different way. If you don't believe that, then what you got to do is you literally have to see these things as a series of events that are all completely different, that have to somehow be happening in history at different times, and they can't be at all time. And that's where it just causes you so many problems when you try to read the book that way. Anyway, the power is in their mouths and their tails. Tails are like serpents' heads, right? So that they have the old evil foe is at the back end of this lion. He looks like he's a lion, but he's in fact a serpent. He's in fact a worm, right? And by this means they wound, verse 20, the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hands, nor give up worshipping demons and idols of gold and silver and bronze and stone and wood, which cannot see or hear or walk, nor did they repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual immorality or their thefts. Which is to say, right, that even though God has sent the curse of death upon us, mankind continues to live in idolatry instead. and trying to make the works of our hands last forever in such a way that we might look on them and be secure. Whether you're going to make a statue and say, oh, Buddha, I worship you, or whether you're simply going to say, I'm going to build something that's going to last for generations. I'm going to have so much wealth, my kids won't ever need to worry about anything at all, right? Same thing. Idol worship, worshiping the works of your hands, not repenting of your fallen condition, which when you repent of it, you own the fact that you're going to die. You own the fact that you will do nothing immortal. You own the fact that the only immortality you will ever have is that which is given in Jesus Christ. And thus you begin to see the great danger of your life as you continually are teased out to breaking the Ten Commandments, murder, fifth commandment, sexual immorality, sixth commandment, theft, seventh commandment. And then you throw sorcery in there, magic. That's your second commandment. That's believing that you can manipulate God or the gods. And the point here in this first part of the sixth trumpet at the back end of chapter 9 is that death has not convinced us that anything's wrong, right? Mankind doesn't see it. But what you do also have here very, very clearly in my mind is we've reset the story, right? We saw the fall of Satan to the pit and the unleashing of the horde, and now we're seeing that this is in fact something which God has allowed from the place of the great river Euphrates, which, by the way, we didn't talk about that, but you know, the great river Euphrates, there's one that's out there today, but there was another great river Euphrates that we don't know where it was, and I have no idea why they decided to name the second one that. It was an ancient world decision, but you remember that in Eden, there's four rivers, and one of them is Euphrates. When they're cast out of Eden with the angel with the flaming sword, you know where they're leaving? They're leaving the great river Euphrates? Out into the realm of death, east of Eden, right? All that. So, I feel like I haven't been clear. So what's just happened in this entire chapter is that Eve ate the fruit, she gave it to Adam. Adam ate the fruit. God found them. They argued with God. God didn't argue with them. God curses them, kicks them out of the garden, promises salvation. And mankind begins to die and be tormented spiritually by the demons to whom we have submitted ourselves. That's what chapter 9, trumpets 5 and 6a, is all about. And we got another immediate decision to make. I don't think we're going to go too much further into that today. But the immediate decision is now. Okay, so it's the end of the chapter in Revelation. And so we just assume, therefore, whatever's next must be something new. Because I don't know why. That's what we do. We're trusting people. We're assuming that the editors know what they're doing. And the chapters and the verse numbers, they're very helpful things, but you just got to know they're not from God. Not in the sense that the rest of the scriptures are. They were not, you know, John was not sitting there going, okay, chapter 10, verse 1. No, he just kept writing. And when the monks, God bless them, that did this, who put the chapters and the verse numbers in there, you know what their primary criteria for verse and chapter spacing was? It wasn't content. It wasn't topic. The primary thing they were doing was length. Length. Because they wanted to be able to, you didn't want a verse that was five sentence long and then a verse that's one sentence long. It'd be hard to find stuff, right? So it was always about length. Not always about sentence, certainly not about paragraph, definitely not about actual content, chapter, thought, topic. So please, do not assume that just because it says 9 verse 21, nor do they repent, and then 10 verse 1, then I saw, don't assume that's a change. Don't assume we're not still in this dying, one-third ransacked, demonic horde, beast, fire, breastplate, sulfur, flowing hairs of women, lion-faced and lion-mouthed and snake-tailed and scorpioned hell. That's where we are. But remember, there was this other thing that happened right there in Genesis 3, along with man and woman being sent out into the curse. They're sent with a promise of a seed who will be born of that woman. So when John immediately sees another mighty angel coming down from heaven wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head and his face like the sun and his legs like pillars of fire, I'm just not sure we've left the sixth trumpet. Now, I'm making kind of a big deal here. Okay, so let's see if I can do this without having to stop and do any editing. We are not going to find the seventh trumpet until chapter 11, verse 15. Okay, so your first four trumpets were like what we would call two verses, one or two verses each. Your fifth trumpet is like, I could kind of tell you just by going fast back here. Come on, internet. Fifth trumpet is 11 verses, maybe 12. Okay. And then the sixth trumpet is either just another eight verses up to where the end of chapter 9 is, or it's a whole another two chapters, chapter 10 and chapter 11, all the way down to verse 15 of chapter 11. So if you're reading along in Brighton's commentary, which again, don't get me wrong, everything that I am trying to teach about this book, I owe to that commentary. Even when I disagree with it, I owe it. I'm standing upon it. It is my father in the understanding, okay? But you're going along and you get to chapter 10, and there's this whole thing, right? This whole setup we've talked about where you have these three sets of sevens, the seals, the trumpets, and the censers, which are still coming. And it like, it's wow, this really helps the book make sense. It's all this big spiral around this the same thing three times in a holy way. And then suddenly, chapter 10, it says excursus. Okay, so what the idea is that in the structure of the book, the way that Brighton understood it, when John gets to chapter 10, he just kind of steps back from everything he was doing and writes a different story for a little while. An excursus, a side point, a tangent. And then once that's over, he's going to come back and go back to the seventh trumpet. And like, okay, fine. You know, we can disagree about this kind of stuff. It really is not going to impact our faith. But I'm still at this point where it's like, why? Why? Why not just believe that the sixth trumpet's kind of long? You know? And it has a lot of stuff in it. Why not? Why not? I think it is, right? I think so. We're in the sixth trumpet part A today. And, you know, chapter 10, hopefully we can do that next time. Chapter 11, we're going to be dealing with the angel who comes down, puts his feet on the land and the sea. It was Jesus. This is Jesus. This is not Gabriel. This is not Michael. This is Jesus. We'll talk about that next time. But the rainbow and the glowing face, I mean, that and the cloud, all those things. If you know your symbology, like you've been listening along, you know all three of those things, right? Come on, you can do it. You can do it. Where's the cloud? The cloud from Mount Sinai comes down and where God is. The cloud on the Mount of Transfiguration surrounds them. It's where God really is, right? The rainbow, the sign of God, which is under the feet of the God who's sitting on the altar, both in the rainbow that's on fire in Ezekiel, and then it's also connected to Revelation chapter 4 and 5. Yeah, remember that? And then the glowing face, I mean, on the Mount of Transfiguration, what was happening to Jesus' face? It was glowing like the sun, right? So all that language, Jesus language. But how was Jesus an angel? The angel of the Lord from the Old Testament. Don't get too hung up on a technical terminology with the Greek word angelos. That word means like four or five different things. It doesn't mean the Hallmark little flying thing with wings. Just don't. That is reading that into every time you see the word angel is like deciding that every time it talks about the end of the world, you're thinking about some special tribulation. You're letting American Christian mythology give you meanings of words that the Bible has not given you. So just how is he an angel? Because he is a messenger. Jesus is a messenger. Is he a created being? No, of course not. Of course not. He's not some elevated angel, as if the angel again just means created being from in a heavenly way that then ascends to a like a godness. No. But remember, in the same book, the seven angels of the seven churches are pastors. Pastors. Preachers. So Jesus is, he's just a messenger, right? That's all he's saying about him now. I saw another messenger. That's the word. The word means messenger. It doesn't mean spirit being. We just have learned to hear it that way. And we'll get into this next time. The angel of the Lord in the Old Testament is Jesus, pre-incarnate Son of God. The messenger of Yahweh is Yahweh. Burning bush, go look it up. It's the messenger of Yahweh, who's the bush. It's Yahweh, who is the bush. Crazy stuff that. Maybe we'll get into that next time too. So you got that part coming next. You got the seed born of woman coming next, right? And that's going to then lead us into the two witnesses, which everyone freaks out about the two witnesses, and every crazy person that ever was thinks they're one of them. And then we hit the seventh trumpet, which frankly is going to be even longer than the sixth. Oh, there's so much good stuff in the seventh trumpet. Assuming you don't need a second excursus to explain it. But okay. Oh, how we doing? You still listening? You still here? What do you think? I don't know. See, now here comes my self-loathing and self-doubt. Like, well, I didn't really do it the way I used to do it, and so it probably isn't very good. And oh man, the people won't like me. Man, self-talk. It's so awful. You do it too, right? You're like always. You're always harder on yourself than anybody else is. You're always living in fear. Yeah, that's part of our condition. I pray. I hope. That at the very least you've been entertained today, and that secondly you've learned from me. you either have learned to despise my position or to embrace my position, that there is no sign before the end of the world that we're still waiting for. Zero, none, zilch, nothing. Nothing's getting worse, nothing's getting better. It's gonna be like it is, right? It's married, given in marriage, no one knows the day or the hour. Tribulation. There is no anything. Jesus is going to come back any day. It's going to be like lightning across the sky. God help us sooner than later. So hopefully you got some of that. And then from there, fifth trumpet, sixth trumpet, same reality, two different pictures, sixth expanding, getting longer, the fall of Satan to the earth, the fall of mankind under Satan's rule. We're going to get into the answer of God to this in Jesus himself, and then the two witnesses, the church of Old and New Testament, standing upon the message that the angel of Yahweh brings in his death and resurrection for you. You call me crazy, but it all makes sense.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes and check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.